Janet, me Donald, Donald, Janet. Now, you two go run the economy, all right? From American Public Media, this is Market Flash. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Friday, the 3rd of March. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Donald Trump gave a big speech this week. Janet Yellen gave a big speech this week. Today, in fact, right here is where the twain shall meet. Catherine Rampell's with the Washington Post. Sadeep Reddy is at Politico. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
So I want to read you two a line from Chair Yellen's speech today. She went to Chicago, gave your standard Fed speech. But in the middle of it, she said this. The economy has essentially met the employment portion of our mandate, and inflation is moving closer to our 2% objective, end of quote. Sudeep, this is basically Fed speak for, we won. We did it. We're out of here.
And we're ready to raise interest rates like we've been promising for 7 or 8 years. And there's a rare brief opening each year when the sun and the stars and the moon all align and the Fed gets to raise interest rates once. They want to do it a few times. Investors are happy. The world is happy. Workers are getting a little happier. And then it closes really quickly. So they want to get in before something else happens that's bad that leads them to not raise interest rates anymore because they've been trying to normalize rates for 8 years. And this is their chance.
Why is this their chance, Catherine?
Because the economy is on much more solid footing. We have low unemployment. Inflation is not, it's not actually quite above target, but it's getting closer to the target. So those various measures coupled with a lot of other metrics suggest that the economy is finally strong enough to withstand a hike in interest rates. And plus, we may have some major fiscal stimulus coming down the pike, which would need to be counterweighted somehow,
That's a very big maybe, and we'll get to that speech in a second. But Sudeep, the deal with this one, the interesting part about this one was that nobody freaked. She basically said we're going to raise rates on a couple of times this year, and nobody freaked.
Nobody freaked yet. This was an interesting moment where we still have 12 days before we get to the actual decision.
That's right.
But this was a interesting moment where investor expectations had been stacked beyond March for a rate increase, and they quickly flipped over. A lot of it is built around maybe a sense that we were going to see some slow normalization. It was couched in enough caution that if things were to go south after this first rate hike, they could pull back. And there's just a feeling that maybe we could actually see some other policy come through. There might be a different tone. There are a lot of maybes there, but it's a different tone.
You guys keep saying that. And I wonder if you were watching the same speech by the president that I was watching on Tuesday, because except for a couple of bullet points on health care, Catherine, there was no detail. There was no nothing to let anybody believe that there was actual plans in place for, say, tax reform or an infrastructure program or anything.
That's true. We still have yet to see any kinds of policies on any of these fronts, or at least anything that the White House supports. There's apparently a secret bill floating around Congress
the
health care bill, exactly, to replace Obamacare. But that said, the direction of most of this legislation, we do know. I mean, whatever the details will be, most likely there will be a tax cut of some kind that is expansionary. Most likely there will be some infrastructure. When it comes, we don't know. You know, the most recent reports are that it may not happen for another year very least.
Yeah.
But again, that is expansionary. That's stimulative for the economy. So, that's something markets want to hear.
And they want to believe it, right, Sudeep? That's the deal.
They want to believe it, and they're going to maintain hope as long as they can,
right,
because they don't want to believe the alternative.
But here's the thing, Sudeep. I mean, Steve Mnuchin, who is in, by the way, his very first job in Washington, D.C., the Secretary of the Treasury, is going around town saying, we're going to have a tax plan done, signed, sealed, delivered by August. Do you believe that?
Of course I don't believe that, not sure most people believe that. Well, there is an important element here and this president knows it, this administration knows it, of maintaining hope, maintaining public confidence, keeping people on your side in the public arena, not necessarily a lot of people don't care about the machinery of Washington, whether this bill is going to get through the House or the Senate. As long as there is a belief that you're going to come out the other side with some kind of change that is a positive for various constituencies, then you'll keep pushing on it. But of course, we're not going to see any of this stuff on a timeline that officials are saying now. But Donald Trump wants to make deals. That's what he does. He wants to make deals. And you know that if you can get the legislative machinery moving, he'll still basically sign a deal that comes out of Congress.
Sudeep Reddy from Politico, Catherine Rempel at The Washington Post. Thanks, you two.
Thanks, Kai.
All right, have a good weekend. On Wall Street today, back to its winning ways by a hair. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The new Secretary of Commerce and point man on a lot of his boss's trade policies, Wilbur Ross, was on CNBC this morning. He said, among other things, that he wants to deal with NAFTA before he turns to Chinese trade. And he talked about something that we have discussed here a couple of times, the border adjustment tax, the plan that's being floated to tax imported goods at about 20% or so, but make it cheaper to export stuff from the United States. The economic rationale here goes like this, that the tax on imports would, in theory, be balanced out by the increase in the value of the dollar that would result from the tax because companies wanting to export to the U.S. would have to buy dollars to pay the tax, and that the government would get a whole lot of money from that tax. Economic theory, though, sometimes falters in reality. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has more now on what might actually happen.
House Republicans in the Trump administration contend a border adjustment tax could help balance the budget, maybe adding about $1 trillion in revenues over 10 years. Annette Nellen studies the legal and accounting side of tax policy at San Jose State University.
I'm not sure it's going to be that extensive. Of course, part of it will depend on what rate they actually talk about.
Republicans are floating a rate of about 20% on imports. Economic theory says a rising dollar will balance out those costs. Carolyn Freund is with the Peterson Institute for International Economics. She says that balance can come in one of two ways. Either wages and prices rise together, or the exchange rate provides a leveler.
So your jeans will cost more, but you'll also be earning more money, so it's a wash to you. Or the dollar's worth more, so those jeans, even though they were taxed, end up costing the same amount.
David French is with the National Retail Federation and says to balance out that kind of tax, the dollar would need to go up about 25%.
It may take a long time for the dollar to move. If it takes 3 to 5 years, that's a lot of pain for consumers and for retail associates while we wait for the dollar to adjust.
But it would likely give a boost to American-made products. The border adjustment tax is currently only a part of the House GOP plan. Neither the Senate nor the White House is 100% on board yet. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
In his speech Tuesday night, as Catherine and Sudeep and I mentioned, President Trump touched on health care a little bit, including the key idea to some GOP members of Congress of using tax credits instead of direct subsidies to help people pay for their insurance. From the Health Desk at WHYY, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein has this repeal and replace update.
President Donald Trump inched the repeal process forward when he endorsed tax credits in his address Tuesday.
That means that they have taken one big uncertainty off the table.
James Capretta is with the Conservative American Enterprise Institute. He says some hardline conservatives are sickened by the idea of the federal government cutting Americans a check to buy insurance, as it does now under Obamacare.
The folks that are opposed to that approach either have to get on board or, you know, vote no on the overall bill, and that's a difficult thing for them to do.
House leadership is hoping to move at a breakneck pace this month, giving critics from the right, from the left, and from industry less time to pick it apart. House committees are expected to unveil the official bill, hard numbers and all, in the next few days. In that leaked version, tax credits range from $2,000 to $4,000, well below Obamacare levels. Harvard economist David Cutler, who helped build the ACA, says that's not enough and could mean at least 10 million people losing coverage.
The way to think about it is you're throwing a sort of 2-foot rope to people in a 20-foot hole. There's just no way that most people can use that amount of money to get out of it.
Another landmine next week, Medicaid, where Republicans are looking to cap how much money they send to states. One headline read today, GOP health plan could cost Minnesota billions. As President Trump said earlier this week, quote, nobody knew health care could be so complicated. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
We did an interview the other day about Wall Street, about why it matters in this economy. Most of the time when you hear that phrase, Wall Street, the reference is to the big banks, the ones that are systemically important and at which most of the post-crisis Dodd-Frank regulations were aimed. The flip side of the big bank coin, though, is the smaller community banking system. And for years, those banks have been worried about Dodd-Frank as well. Marketplace's Marielle Segarra has that story.
Chris Martin is sitting in his office at the headquarters of Provident Bank, a community bank in New Jersey. There are some paintings and awards on the wall, and he uses a standing desk.
Just to reduce the level of heart attack.
Otherwise, the CEO's office is sparsely decorated.
One would say that I'm parsimonious, so that would be that special word for being cheap. But we'll spend money to make money.
What he doesn't like is spending money complying with Dodd-Frank.
I will always say, tell me how that helped the market. Tell me how that helped the government. Then I'll be more than willing to say, yeah, that's a good rule. Most of the things that we're doing are, it's busy work.
Since the law went into effect, Provident Bank has hired 4 or 5 people to make sure the bank is complying with various regulations. And the costs are about to go up because Provident is close to a milestone.
We're $9.5 billion in assets.
Once a bank reaches $10 billion in assets, it has to follow more rules under Dodd-Frank. Martin won't say how much compliance has cost so far, but he says the next level of regulations will add $6.5 to $7 million a year. Community banks say it's harder for them to bear these costs than it is for big banks. Professor Lawrence J. White, who teaches economics at the NYU Stern School of Business, says that's true.
To comply with regulation usually involves some fixed costs, like you may need to hire a lawyer.
The smaller the bank, the harder it is to pay that person's salary. The total number of banks in the United States has been dropping for decades because of competition and regulation. And Wayne Abernathy with the American Bankers Association says Dodd-Frank has contributed to that consolidation.
What it means is there's an increased incentive for community banks to merge.
Community banks made about 8% more loans in 2016 than the year before, according to the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. But Abernathy says the regulation is stopping them from making loans to people who don't fit a certain mold.
They're making loans to their best customers. That's what the regulators basically will allow them to do. They're less able to make loans to the new firm, to somebody whose credit is not sterling.
Even some bankers say that's kind of the point. The headquarters of Amalgamated Bank, a community bank with $4 billion in commercial assets, is on 7th Avenue in Manhattan, on a block where the footprint of trillion-dollar banks is everywhere. There's a TD Bank, a Bank of America, even a Citibike bike share station around the corner. Keith Mestrich is Amalgamated's CEO.
Let's remember in 2008, part of this was a mortgage crisis that was caused by a lot of people being able to borrow money when they were not really qualified to do it. And I think Dodd-Frank has done a good job of protecting against those kinds of abuses.
Mestrich says because of Dodd-Frank, the bank has more money set aside so it can withstand shocks to the economy.
I think it means that we have slowed down, that we have taken the precautions to make sure that we don't do the riskiest kinds of loans.
It's unclear exactly what Dodd-Frank reform for community banks would look like. Republican lawmakers have proposed changing some rules so they don't apply to smaller banks. Elizabeth Sanders, who teaches government at Cornell, says it'll be hard to get support from Democrats, who might worry that'll open the door to reforms for the big banks.
A lot of people who believe in regulation are going to be scared, and they're going to think, well, better just to obstruct that.
With a Republican majority in Congress, those changes could happen anyway. In New York, I'm Marielle Segarra for Marketplace.
Coming up.
One person started crying. I mean, it's overwhelming.
And you thought business and economics was dry, didn't you? First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 2 points today, basically flat, 21,005. NASDAQ up 9 points, about a 10%, 5870. S&P 500 up a point, basically flat, 2383. For the 5 days gone by, the Dow up 0.9%, the NASDAQ up 0.4%, S&P 500 up 0.7%. Keeping on, keeping on with community banks. Bank of the Ozarks added almost 2%. Today, New York-based Signature Bank pushed ahead 1.7%. Pacific Continental Corp in Oregon and Washington up 1% today. After weak earnings, hipster retailer Urban Outfitters declined 0.3%. Today, L Brands, parent of Victoria's Secret, took off about 2%. Bonds also flat. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note was flat at 2.48%. You're listening to Marketplace. If you want to get smarter about the things we talk about on this program every day,
technology, the economy, pop culture,
check out our podcast. It's called Make Me Smart. Me and Molly Wood.
We've got new episodes every week. Find us at marketplace.org/makemesmart or wherever you get your podcasts.
Follow us on Twitter for updates. I'm at Kai Rizdahl.
And I'm at Molly Wood.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Forget got milk. Try what is milk. Anyway, the Wall Street Journal noted today that makers of plant and nut-based dairy products, think soy and coconut and almonds, to name a couple, filed a petition yesterday with the Food and Drug Administration seeking to preserve their right to call their products milk. That's a response to actual cow-based dairy producers lobbying Congress exactly the other way because have you seen all the business opportunities in the dairy aisle lately? Marketplace's Adam Allington reports.
Walk with me, if you would, over to the dairy aisle. You've got your skim milk, your 2%, whole milk, my favorite, but you're also going to see plenty of soy milk, almond milk, and rice milk. But sales of regular old cow's milk have been going down for years.
Fresh fluid milk has a much smaller share in the dairy case.
John Newton is director of market intelligence for the American Farm Bureau Federation. According to the USDA, overall milk consumption is down around 40% since 1975.
And so I think there is legitimate concern that their market space has shrunk in the dairy case.
Chris Galen is a spokesman for the National Milk Producers Federation. He says, as it's described by the Food and Drug Administration, milk refers to a product coming from lactating cows.
They don't come from nuts or beans or seeds or grains.
Without standardized definitions for food items, Galen says companies can use slick marketing to mislead consumers.
They will go to great lengths to take a handful of almonds or other seeds, blend them with powders and waters and emulsifiers and sweeteners and whiteners, and make it look like milk, but they're not offering the same amount of nutrition.
Bruce Friedrich is with the Good Food Institute, which represents the plant-based products. He says these products are healthy, that consumers know what they're buying, and that he says the dairy farmers are basically lobbying for censorship.
They're asking the government to step into the marketplace and preference their products over a competing product because they're having trouble competing.
Friedrich says the issue is not about truth in labeling, but about protecting the $16 billion a year cow milk industry. I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
I'm a skim guy myself, by the way. Today in technology cuts both ways, mobile ordering. That thing where with Starbucks, for instance, you can order on your app, saunter into the store 6 or 8 minutes later, and there your order is. No muss, no fuss, no waiting. The thing is, that jams up the line of people who just stopped in to get a cup of coffee. So enter now McDonald's, which said this week that in an attempt to reverse a continuing slump in sales, it too is going to go with mobile ordering for curbside pickup and even delivery. Might it work? Here's Marketplace's Sally Herships.
Joseph Taro studies the interaction between digital media, marketing, and society at the University of Pennsylvania. Recently, he was in an airport in Europe.
And I was looking for some coffee. I went over to McDonald's. The line was unbelievable.
Not just the line at the counter.
But the line was also huge in front of these big boards, these touchscreen boards.
Digital kiosks. So he got his coffee somewhere else. Ordering with a touchscreen or from your phone is big in Europe and growing here. Now McDonald's is jumping on it.
This is not a terrifically new idea. There have been pizza shops doing this for a long time.
Ordering from a mobile app, pizza places also offer delivery, another service McDonald's says it's experimenting with. Ed Doyle is president of Real Food Consulting.
if we start talking about delivery, it gets pretty complicated pretty quick.
Doyle says a cheeseburger is cheap, but delivering a cheeseburger is not, at least not in the U.S. Internationally, McDonald's delivers almost $1 billion of food a year, where Doyle says gas and labor is less expensive. He's not sure how McDonald's will make delivery profitable here.
Here in the U.S., it costs a lot more than it does in some of the overseas markets to put someone on a bike, on a motorcycle, or in a car to deliver a burger.
Stephen Dutton is with Euromonitor International. He says this is all part of a strategy of wooing consumers back, especially millennials.
Experimenting with sustainable sourcing and cleaner ingredients.
And if a new app causes other consumers to wait,
dealing with too many customers isn't the worst problem to have.
McDonald's says consumers will be able to order using an app by the end of the year. I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Given the lay of the political land in Washington, things are pretty well lined up for some major policy changes in this economy. Changes that, if the past 5 weeks are any guide, will not be entirely predictable. Which, regular listeners to this program will know, is making corporate America crazy. Businesses are trying to prepare their bottom lines for whatever may come. CEOs are reading Art of the Deal. Others are hiring consultants who can war game for them. And plenty of them are hitting the pavement on Capitol Hill. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore has that story.
Vincent Lewis is chairman of a company called Logos at Work.
It's a printing and promotions company.
So they would make uniforms or shirts with your company's logo on it.
My wife is now the CEO.
He also happens to teach entrepreneurship at the University of Dayton.
We're entering a period that we really haven't been in before, right? Because it's kind of this combination of what you would call a traditional Republican growth agenda, but it's combined with this very non-traditional tariff protection type of approach.
Many industries in the U.S. currently face the possibility of major policy changes, from tax reform to healthcare reform to trade policy, that are both far-reaching and seriously unpredictable. Depending on the industry, tax cuts could be a blessing, while tariffs and border taxes could be devastating.
That really has a lot of business owners kind of scratching their head about what to do.
It's an uncertain time, and uncertainty drives CEOs crazy.
Matt Priest is president of the Footwear Distributors and Retailers of America. He says, like many businesses, his members are just trying to get the basic facts about how trade barriers and tax cuts, whatever they might be, would affect them.
A number of our members have engaged with their outside accounting firms to kind of ascertain the impact.
Jim O'Brien is a vice chair at Albright Stonebridge Group, a global strategy firm. He has gotten a lot of calls.
A lot of scenario planning about how they can adjust their investments in other countries. Other companies are trying to understand the effect of imports and exports.
That's a question Beth Pride has been getting a lot. She's president of consulting firm BPE Global.
We've seen everything from medical device companies, high-tech companies.
So she ended up developing a tool for them.
So it's a simple calculator.
It crunches a company's import data and applies different tariff scenarios to figure out the effect on the bottom line.
Here, I'll give you an example. This is an importer. Their average duty rate in 2016 was 0.48%. If we look at the statements that have been made as president, let's build the Mexican wall and have Mexico pay for it. Their increase in duties is 944%. They'll be paying $2 million additional in duties.
That result, she says, has been pretty typical. Many retailers say changes to the corporate income tax wouldn't even come close to making up for a border tax.
One person started crying. I mean, it's overwhelming.
Moving supply chains around or even back to the U.S. is not so easy. David Whiston is equity strategist with Morningstar and covers the automotive industry.
You don't just immediately start moving pickup truck production from Mexico to the United States, you know, the next day. It could take years to retool a plant. It takes a ton of money, too.
While different companies have different outlooks, most all have one thing in common. They want to be heard in Washington. Again, Jim O'Brien with the Albright Stonebridge Group.
What we see from some of our clients is that they're beefing up their presence in Washington. So I think the Trump administration has been very good for the firms that do lobbying.
So until more information is known about what the Trump administration will end up doing, when it will do it, and what order it will do it in, businesses are left to mull over the possibilities.
companies are dealing with uncertainty. It's like they're standing on a beach and looking at a tsunami kind of coming their way, and they don't know any steps they can take.
Will it be a wave they can ride, or do they need to run for higher ground? In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, which comes with the observation, y'all, that it is Friday, and maybe it would be a good idea to take the next 2 days off from the news, huh? The YMCA in Scranton, Pennsylvania, has banned 24-hour news channels on its TVs because management says people were getting into, and this is a quote, boisterous conversations. No fisticuffs, but they did want to get things back under control. I will get off of my phone if you get off of your phone, all right? All right, here's the thing. I really can't get off my phone. It's kind of my job. Journalism, you know, news. All right, we got to go. Theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Nancy Fargali. Sitar Nieves is the executive producer. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president. Wall Street today was flat, by the way. That's why I skipped that. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have a great weekend, everybody. All right? This is APM.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.